Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome back to As It Is. We come to you 7 days a week from the Voice of America in Washington. Each day, we present interesting stories from around the world, and we try to do it in a way that makes it easy to understand if English is not your first language. Today, a special program about recent developments on the Korean Peninsula. Then, news about business and economics. We will end the program with more American history on the making of a nation. As It is on the air and on the Internet right now. Mario Ritter is here with important information.
South Korean officials stated their concerns about North Korea's first missile test launch from a submarine. The test does not immediately change the military situation on the Korean Peninsula. However, it shows that North Korea is working on a missile system that is difficult to detect and could threaten countries around the world. A spokesman for the South Korean Defense Ministry, Kim Min-sook, confirmed that North Korea did test fire an underwater ballistic missile on May 8th. He called the test a serious concern. Mr. Kim also urged North Korea to stop developing the weapon immediately. However, Mr. Kim also says the test shows North Korea is years away from deploying this new capability. He says the ministry believes North Korea's test fire shows the country is in the early stages of developing a submarine-launched ballistic missile program. Mr. Kim says advanced countries take 4 to 5 years after an underwater test to complete the system. However, the fact that North Korea is on a path to develop a submarine-based missile system means it could develop the ability to strike anywhere in the world. Targets could include the mainland of the United States. The North's new ability could also hurt the effectiveness of South Korea's current kill-chain missile system. This system is designed to target and destroy North Korean missile launch sites. The increased North Korean threat could start a new arms race on the Korean Peninsula. Some could also use the threat to justify deploying the United States anti-ballistic missile system called THAAD. South Korea has not wanted to accept the THAAD missile system because China opposes the move. South Korea's defense ministry spokesman says his country is sure it can, in his words, strongly respond to a missile attack from a North Korean submarine. Bruce Bennett studies defense issues for the RAND Corporation, a research group. He said what North Korea got as a result of the test launch remains unclear. I haven't seen any description of what exactly happened to the missile after it left the water, Mr. Bennett said. He also wondered if North Korea has a submarine equipped to fire a missile beyond the Korean Peninsula. But he noted that the launch represents a threat to South Korea and Japan. If you can fire 2 or 3 missiles at South Korea or Japan, he said, that's relatively a significant capability and would require new efforts for defense against it. Defense expert Shin In-kyun is with the Korea Defense Network. He says South Korea needs to prevent missile attacks if the North moves to arm a ballistic missile with a nuclear weapon. North Korea has not shown it can make a small nuclear warhead. However, U.S. military authorities recently said they believe North Korea has the ability to fit a nuclear weapon on a long-distance missile. Shin In-kyun says the U.S., South Korea, and other allies need to develop the ability to contain this threat at once. He says the allies need to be able to launch a preemptive attack by deploying U.S. nuclear submarines. He says they could hide near North Korea's submarine port on Maeyong Island and strike the North's submarines if there is an attack. The submarine missile test took place days after U.S. and South Korean diplomats met to discuss the possibility of opening exploratory talks with the North. The two countries may be considering a compromise to meet North Korea's demand for unconditional talks by using the word exploratory rather than formal negotiations. The compromise would temporarily suspend the U.S. demand that North Korea first take clear steps to halt its nuclear program. Shin In-kyun says by carrying out the missile test, North Korea is sending a message that it is not ready to offer any compromises on its own. North Korea wants the right to test fire missiles in addition to restarting six-party talks without preconditions. The U.S. State Department has called on North Korea to avoid raising tensions in the area. It says launches using ballistic missile technology are a clear violation of UN Security Council resolutions. North Korea is under UN sanctions, which ban the country from developing or using ballistic missile technology. North Korea's official news agency, KCNA, reports that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un called the launch an eye-opening success. I'm Mario Ritter.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. In a few minutes, news about business and economics, and more American history on the making of a nation. Many people in this country are remembering the birth of Lyman Frank Baum. He was born on May 15, 1856, in New York State. He wrote stories for American newspapers, but he is probably much better known for his series of children's books about a make-believe land where magical things happened. Oh, now you recognize the name. L. Frank Baum wrote The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. It is considered an American classic, as is the movie by the same name that starred Judy Garland. 3 years to the day after Frank Baum was born, the Curie family in Paris, France, was welcoming a son to the world. Pierre is considered one of the founders of modern physics. As an adult, he married Marie, and together the Curies made many scientific discoveries. They are probably best known for their work regarding radioactivity and for winning the Nobel Prize in 1903. Tenzing Norgay was born on May 15, 1914. He was the famous Sherpa, or mountain guide, who went up Mount Everest, the world's highest peak, with Edmund Hillary of New Zealand. It was May 29th of 1953 when the two men entered the history books as the first to ever climb all the way to the top of the Himalayan height and return to base camp safely. On this date in 1890, Katherine Ann Porter was born. She became the American writer famous for the book Ship of Fools in 1962. Her honors include a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. The American technology company Google recently set up its first campus in Asia. The campus opened last Friday in Seoul, South Korea. Google officials want the training center to support entrepreneurs who are starting up new internet businesses. They hope this will lead to more Korean high technology programs in the world market. In return, the company wants more ties to the Korean market. Campus Seoul, a Google space, is small compared to Google's headquarters in Mountain View, California. The company controls a large number of buildings and green spaces in what is known as Silicon Valley. Google's new campus can be found in an office building in Seoul's Gangnam neighborhood. It will have 2,000 square meters of open office space where Korean internet entrepreneurs can work. Google's expectations for the campus, however, are much bigger than the relatively small space. The company wants to make it a place for new ideas in Asia. Mary Grove is director of Google for Entrepreneurs. She says that at Campus Seoul, internet program developers will get support, mentoring, possible contacts, and help finding investors. She says the company is providing this supportive environment without cost. She thinks this will also help Google gain entry to the Korean market.
Google benefits when startups succeed as well. We understand that the more startups that are created, companies who come online, use the internet, use Google products, it benefits us as well.
South Korea is one of the few countries in the world where Google is not the top internet search engine. The Korean company Naver has a larger market share. Google operates similar centers in London and Tel Aviv. But this is the company's first campus in East Asia. Google says its London campus has helped startup companies create 18,000 new jobs and get over $110 million in investments. One of the Campus Seoul members is April Kim. She started an internet-based translation service called Chatting Cat. She says she likes the workspace and conference areas. She adds that people at the campus can share information and concerns with others there, and they can provide motivation for each other. Google decided on Seoul because it has some of the fastest internet speeds and many talented, well-educated engineers. The city also has one of the highest percentages of smartphone users in the world. Jungmin Lim is the director of Campus Seoul. He says the South Korean government has also made it easier to launch new businesses. He says a few years ago, the government canceled many rules for new businesses and provided policies supporting startups. South Korean President Park Geun-hye attended the opening of Campus Seoul. In 2013, her administration provided $3 billion to assist new high-tech companies grow and compete around the world.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In recent programs, we talked about how the rise of fascist leaders in Europe threatened American neutrality in the 1930s. Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party in Germany created the most obvious threat. But there was also Benito Mussolini in Italy and Francisco Franco in Spain. These leaders challenged both the idea of democracy and the security of some of America's closest allies. Hitler's invasion of Poland and the spread of war in Europe in 1939 made Americans wonder if they could remain neutral much longer. The United States would finally go to war against Hitler and the other Axis nations. But its first battle would not be in Europe at all. Instead, the United States would enter World War II following a surprise attack by Japan on the large American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Relations between the United States and Japan had grown steadily worse throughout the 1930s. Both nations were important industrial powers, but they had very different ideas about the economic and political future of East Asia, especially China. Until the late 1800s, Japan had been a nation with ancient political traditions and little contact with the Western world. Visits by Commodore Matthew Perry and American warships helped open Japan to trade with the United States and other nations in the 1850s. And in the years that followed, Japan took major steps toward becoming a modern industrial nation. By the 1920s and 30s, Japan was a strong country, but it lacked oil, rubber, and other natural resources of its own. For this reason, Japanese political leaders looked with envy at the Dutch, French, and British colonies across Southeast Asia and the Pacific. And Japanese business leaders saw huge markets for their products in nearby countries like Korea and China. Japan's desire to use East Asia to gain natural resources and sell manufactured products was in direct conflict with American plans for Asia. This was especially true concerning China. Washington created an open-door policy toward China. It wanted to keep China's natural resources and markets free from control by Japan or any other nation. For this reason, Americans were very concerned when Japanese forces invaded the Manchuria area of China in 1931. And they watched with great interest the efforts of Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek to oppose the Japanese invaders. The United States was also very concerned about protecting its imports of oil, tin, and rubber from Southeast Asia. This area of the world was a major supplier of these resources in the 1930s. The Middle East had not yet become a leading producer of oil. In these ways, the United States and Japan were competing for the same resources and Asian markets.
However, there also was a good deal of trade between the two nations. In fact, Japan depended on the United States for most of its metal, copper, and oil. This trade with Tokyo became a major concern for President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Congress in 1937. In the summer of that year, more Japanese troops moved into China. They quickly captured much of the Chinese coast. Much of the metal, oil, and other materials that Japan used for its war effort in China came from the United States. Americans did not like selling Japan materials to use against China, but the trade was legal because of a 1911 agreement between Tokyo and Washington. However, the American government told Japan in 1939 that it would end the earlier agreement. It would no longer sell Japan materials that could be used for war. Washington's decision made the Japanese government think again about its expansionist plans, and the announcement a month later of a non-aggression treaty between Germany and the Soviet Union gave Tokyo even more cause for concern. The Soviet Union could be a major opponent of Japanese expansion in East Asia, and it appeared free from the threat of war in Europe. These two events helped moderates in the Japanese government to gain more influence over foreign policy. A moderate government took power in January 1940. However, this period of moderation in Tokyo did not last long. In the spring of 1940, Germany launched its Blitzkrieg, or lightning invasion of Europe. The Nazis captured Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, and finally France. Extremists in the Japanese government saw the German victory as their chance to launch their own attack on European colonies in Asia. They quickly began negotiations with Hitler to form a new alliance, and within months, militant leaders overthrew the moderate government in Tokyo. The new Japanese government was headed by a moderate, Prince Konoye, but the Minister of War was an expansionist, General Tojo. Tokyo wasted no time in taking action. It forced France to give Japan permission to occupy northern Indochina, and Tokyo also demanded that Britain close the Burma Road to the Chinese city then known as Chongqing. The Burma Road was a major route by which the United States was supplying China with munitions as part of the Lend-Lease Act. These events caused relations between Tokyo and Washington to become even worse. In the second half of 1940, President Roosevelt banned the export of metal and oil products to Japan. His administration also lent money to China. America began to supply Chiang Kai-shek's government with a fleet of P-40 fighter airplanes with volunteer pilots led by Army aviator Claire Chennault to train Chinese pilots. The squadron became known as the Flying Tigers. American representatives quietly began to meet with British and Dutch officials to discuss joint defense plans for possible Japanese attacks in the Western Pacific. Washington and Tokyo held long negotiations in 1941. The American officials hoped the negotiations might delay Japan from launching an attack to the south. They also thought that a delay might give more moderate leaders in Japan a chance to gain more influence. And, for a time, the American plan worked. Japan did not make new acts of aggression. Again, events in Europe caused this situation to change. Nazi Germany attacked the Soviet Union in the middle of 1941. This prevented Moscow from doing any fighting on its eastern borders, so Japanese troops were free to invade southern Indochina. President Roosevelt reacted to Japan's invasion of Indochina by taking three major steps. First, he took control of all Japanese money in the United States. Second, he brought the armed forces of the Philippines under American command. And third, he closed the Panama Canal to Japanese shipping. Once again, a conflict developed between moderates and extremists in the Japanese government. More moderate leaders, such as Prime Minister Konoye, urged one more effort to reach an agreement with the United States. But the Japanese Army and Navy believed that the time had come to go to war to end American and European power in East Asia forever. Negotiations between Japan and the United States continued through the final months of 1941. But the two nations were on the edge of war. They were as close to hostilities as Washington was with the Nazi government in Berlin. American military officials captured secret messages from Japan during this time. They learned that Tokyo was planning an attack of some kind unless the United States suddenly changed its policies. However, the American officials could not discover exactly where or how the attack would be made. Almost everyone in Washington expected that the Japanese would attack south of Japan. They were wrong. The military leaders in Tokyo were planning a surprise attack on America's main Pacific military base at Pearl Harbor. That will be our story next week. Our program was written by David Jarmel. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.